Started.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a November 6, 2008 webcast from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight we're trying to connect to a November meeting of a British Columbia grassroots alternative energy group known as New Energy Movement Canada. Now, their special guest speaker tonight is George Wiseman of Eagle Research. So we hope that they will succeed in making this connection and you'll be able to hear their meeting. After a five-minute introductory comments, George is going to speak for about an hour, and he will be followed by some other speakers that should be of interest to those who are pursuing alternative energy technology. So what we'll do is just hang tight, wait for them to make this connection. If they do, if they don't, we'll just call it off and hope that someone has done some recording of the event so that it can be posted on YouTube or somewhere else. However, in the interim, I would like to mention that Gene Manning, who is scheduled to speak at this event, has just produced a new book. Now, many are familiar with Gene's 1996 book entitled The New Energy Revolution. Her current book, which she wrote along with Joel Garbon, is entitled Breakthrough Power: How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. So that book is available. It can be purchased at Amazon.com, or it can be purchased at the website for that book, which is www.breakthroughpower.net. And at that website, there are some fine descriptions of the contents of the book and so on. So let's see if we don't have, no, still no caller. So what we're going to do is we're going to mute the microphone here and wait for them to call in. And hopefully within the next minute or two, we'll have a connection and be able to listen to their program. Thank you for your patience.
Hello?
Hello. Are you there?
Are you James?
Yes. Yes.
This is Peter Scholl. I'm with the New Energy Movement in Vancouver.
Oh, very good. Yes, very, very good. You're on the air.
Okay, and we're about to announce George Wiseman.
Excellent.
So do we have some kind of a feedback that we know whether or not you are getting the signal here? Do you think
I can hear the people talking in the background, so that means that we do have a signal.
Okay.
I can hear the voices of those people behind you. So if you would just set the phone down in such a way that it can pick up the sound from the auditorium without a lot of background noise from people standing nearby.
Okay.
Then we should be able to pick up your program for the benefit of people around the world.
Okay. Well, I'm going to place it down here next to the projector. And,
okay, well, this is the most high-tech connection, but I think it'll work.
Okay.
I'm sure in the future we might be able to do better.
And how long would you like to have it on, during the full presentation or just a segment? Or
we have a total of 2 hours time allotted for this program. It can run over that without any problem.
Okay.
How long do you anticipate the program lasting?
Probably an hour and a half or so.
Okay, very good. Well, then we'll monitor it and we'll shut the program down when you come to a conclusion there.
Okay. Yeah, because once I put the phone down and you want to communicate with me, you can. So,
Think that'll be necessary. What we basically want to do is allow our listening audience to benefit from your program.
Okay, and this is not live, right?
Yes, we are live right now. Uh-huh.
You are live?
Yes, we are live.
Okay, all right. So it should be another maybe 5 minutes or so.
That's fine. We have a very patient audience.
Okay.
They're accustomed to this kind of thing.
Yeah, the president of the New Energy Movement is about to make her announcement. So,
and who would that be?
Tell,
is that Jane Manning?
Susan McPhee.
Oh, Susan McPhee. Okay,
very good. Susan McPhee, yes.
Now, if at any time during this program you want to pick up the phone and explain who's coming up next, that would be fine.
Okay.
If you'd like to identify the speakers.
Okay, most likely it will be just Susan McPhee, and then she will introduce... Okay, she will introduce Jane Manning, and then Jane Manning will be introducing the speaker.
Very good. And that would be George Wiseman, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to hearing the program.
Okay, James, I'm just going to be probably sitting here and holding the phone because I'm fairly close to a speaker. Okay?
Well, we really appreciate your help.
Okay, James. Thanks.
Okay.
It was good talking to you.
Uh-huh, very well.
Okay. Bye-bye. Looks like we're finally getting there.
Thank you.
So it's a real pleasure to talk with you.
people like yourselves, because you're exactly the kind of people who will actually go out there and do something, and then the feedback comes, I help other people, and then other people help myself as well. So the whole technology at a grassroots level continues to develop. So tonight we'll be talking about water as fuel, the real story, meaning what's out there right now. We will start with a quote from, I'm quite certain virtually everybody in this room is familiar with Jules Verne's work. And in 1870, he said, and this quote isn't exact, it's just pieces of his, out of his book, The Mysterious Island, I believe the water will one day be employed as fuel, will furnish an inexhaustible source of heat and light, of an intensity of which coal is not capable. Water will be the coal of the future. And tonight I'll be able to give you some insight into that actual thing that Jules Verne said. In fact, virtually all of his books, interestingly enough, Earth to the Moon, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which essentially was nuclear-powered submarine and what have you, incredible visionary. I'm not sure how he did it with the technology that existed in 1870, but he did. The first thing to address in this, or I feel like addressing, again, I appreciate you being converted, but the thing that I find is the world is flat mentality out there. The scientists essentially are taught what exists, and then they don't think ahead. They simply respond as skeptics, if you will, to any innovations that happen to be coming down the pipe. They believe what exists. It's very few individuals who can actually say there was stuff that we didn't know. Before gravity, apples fell to the ground every year. They didn't probably before mankind. But nobody knew what gravity was. They didn't think about it. But the fact that they didn't think about it didn't mean it didn't exist. The fact that it couldn't be measured didn't mean it didn't exist. And this is exactly what the scientists are saying. If something can't be measured, it doesn't exist. And we all know that this isn't true. There's a lot of things that can't be measured, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. Innovators have to assume that we're ignorant. If we think we know everything, then why is there any reason to continue trying to develop something better? But there's also another thing that I have personally run into, and that's suppression by what I call vested interest. When we are in the alternative energy field, coming up against a business that is multiple trillions of dollars a year that these power energy monopolies have, there's energy monopolies like BP who are saying, okay, we're going to go off into these other alternative energy technologies. What they're trying to do is in such a way that they can still make money at it. Nikola Tesla wanted to essentially give free energy to the world. Now, we can duplicate what he had then, but it's easily provable, or at least from the documentation, it looks like he truly had a wireless power system that somebody in Africa could put up an antenna and ride across. The stuff existed. It has existed on the planet over 100 years ago. And I don't know how many times the greatest technologies have existed, but
it never is to hear me well. I'm just going to call you.
But these sort of energy technologies have existed many times on the planet. The kind of things I'm going to be showing you tonight have been around for a long time, have been invented again and again. And one of the main reasons why they aren't on the market is because of patents. The reason I don't patent is because I recognize this exact thing. Of course, it really helped that I was able to write a book and start making money on it right away. Instead of trying to patent this idea or innovation, spending thousands of dollars, years of my life, and then probably having it stolen from me or being suppressed anyway. Which is what I'm trying to tell people, is that if you can essentially give it away, you can go with a copyright. You still control your words, you still control your rights. In fact, copyrights have So you have a much better control of a copyright than a patent. And with this, I'm able to distribute the information and then synergy collaboration kind of thing. So it's important to bypass the best interest in some way. The best interests tend to use the patent process to suppress innovation. Because if somebody goes for a patent, they know two things. Number one, they haven't told anyone else. And number two, they know that you think you have something. So somebody like myself who isn't patenting generally flies under that sort of radar, putting itself directly out to the public. My technology tends to get out there. For example, at the time that I was selling a carburetor enhancer, I did a patent search in the patent library in Idaho and found that there were, since 1975, there were 2,500 still living patents in the library. Not one of which is on the market. Not one. My stuff went on the market and has been on between on tens of thousands, over 100,000 years. So, as everyone here is knowing, we need eco-friendly power now. We absolutely have to have eco-friendly power. We are not going to run out of oil or essentially carbon-based fuel. If this isn't going to happen, anything like our kids' lifetime, their kids' lifetime, there is enough carbon-based burnable fuel on the planet in various formations. In one of the biggest, actually, is what's called methane hydrate, and it's under the ocean. There's an entire huge quantity of it that essentially methane in an ice form, that as soon as the ocean starts to warm up even a little bit, that methane is going to be released into the atmosphere and ocean. And methane is 20 times worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So actually tapping those resources and using them to make hydrogen and carbon, which we can use the carbon to make actual good. This is one of the things that Roy McAllister, the American Hydrogen Association in the United States, is promoting, and I seriously agree with it, that carbon should not be burned. Carbon has a huge number of applications that, without being burned, burn the hydrogen, and that just turns into water. Burn the carbon, you've lost valuable. Alternative energy is good for the economy. One of the things that vested interest says is that you take the infrastructure that we have now and go with free energy, the economy is going to collapse. All these gas stations on the corner and all the convenience stores, they'll all just collapse. But you see the gas stations closing anyway. Those poor people, some friends of mine, for example, own gas stations, and they only make a couple of cents a week. So there's a huge amount of money going in to this park, but also going out. They make very little on the actual gas stations. The infrastructure that's in place could be replaced with an alternative or free energy technology. Everyone would make more money. There's been two studies that I know of, and essentially it works like this. The gross national product of any country rises with its energy capacity. How much energy they have available is how much the economy grows. And whether jobs for people are going in this job or this job, it doesn't matter. What matters is the more energy is available, the more productive the country is. Period. Now, the thing is, I'm pointing out here, is water a primary or carrier? Because hydrogen is known as a carrier of energy, it's not a primary, similar to a primary fuel source. Because hydrogen is tied up in things like water or methane, various carbon-based fuels. It's energy has to be put in to separate it. So is water an actual fuel, or is it the ashes of burning? I'll show both. There are ways, I believe, that water can be made a primary fuel. Water contains a huge amount of energy in and of itself, as does every single molecule that exists. And there are ways of tapping into that energy. We need to go to a sustainable hydrogen economy. This is my opinion. The hydrogen economy would be clean, straight across the board. But the infrastructure is not in place, obviously. There's significant problems that need to be solved. For example, transportation. If you can develop your hydrogen at the source and where you're using it, that'd be the best. But there are a lot of places that need to have hydrogen developed elsewhere, like we had huge solar farms in the desert, then the hydrogen would be best tight for the city instead of taking in tanker trucks. The tanker trucks, especially if it's liquid hydrogen, are extremely wasteful of the hydrogen. So, some of the innovators of the various technologies, I'll just list ones that I'm generally not going to be speaking about tonight. And this is important. My Water at Fuel book explains a bunch of this sort of thing. And anything that's in the book, I'm pretty well not talking about tonight. If you can go on my website and buy the book, you won't be duplicating things that you're hearing tonight. There'll be additional information. You've probably heard these names. Archie Drew, Paul Boyd, Dan Danforth, Samuel Friesen, Henry Gadd, Gert Jurek, Rudolf Donnerman, William C. Hepperman, Stephen Horvath, Brian Jenkins, Dean Joseph, Sam Leach, Anthony Minor, Dan Marsman, Francisco Paschio, and I may be mispronouncing some of these names. Unfortunately, on my research, I may not hear them. I may just see them in print. Andrea Kucharch. Pardon? Kucharch. Thank you very much. Frank Roberts, John Sorensen, Zach West, and there's quite a few more. I want to, those are ones that I feel actually had something. But I say with a grain of salt, I would be careful of plans from Carl Sella, Creative Science, Hydrostar, and Spirit of Math. I'm not saying that the stuff they have doesn't have gems of what's in it, but they've been around a long time, and a lot of people have tried to duplicate it and have failed. So I'm thinking that in these particular types of innovation, especially ones like creative science, I think what they tend to do is compile everything that they can find into a document and then send it out there with the promise that it will work, assuming that it will work, that somebody can make it work. And in some cases, maybe we have, but I haven't been able to personally verify any of that. So I'm really against compilers that don't do original research. What I do is I do compile, but then I actually make stuff that works, then write a book on it and send it out. It may take me a while, but nothing I sell, unless I specifically say so. I don't have anything here. The Water is Fuel book, for example, is a compilation of things that I've discovered. But I don't say anywhere in the book that you're actually going to use water as fuel. This is just what I'm reporting on what people have done. But then I take some things, like the hydro technology, onboard electrolyzer for vehicles. This is a sample over here. This is what it looks like when it's commercial fun. This is a transparent experiment. The transparent experiment is nice because I can actually look inside the machine as it's operating and see what's going on. So I can optimize inside. There's 10 generations of those particular six designs, which is the one you're looking at right there. So here's the sixth book of the, six comparative books that is state-of-the-art onboard electrolyzer technology. Nobody's got anything like this because I've been doing this since 74. The people that are kind of getting on board now, I just want them to read my book. I would personally love, for example, in this Extreme Mileage 101 book, which is a totally different technology having to do with cracking, thermal cracking the fuel, you can get 10 times the mileage on a gallon of gas. If I had the information that was in this book 20 years ago when I started doing the experiments and research on it, I'd be much farther ahead today than I am. So I tried to put together everything I knew and that people would need to be able to take this technology to the next level, not to time gone, which is one of the big problems that the inventor had, of course, as soon as the vested interest neutralizes that inventor by buying them out, for example, I have some names, so I'll talk about a little bit later, that that's actually happened with, or just simply telling them, one way or another. There are a lot of free energy researchers, average-wise, their lifespan is considerably less than the general public. So, Buell Brown is one I won't be talking about tonight very much, but the except for by now, he is what I named the brown cat after. He named brown cat, and I continue to put brown cat because that's the gas that's coming out of these electrolyzers and my water torches, and they and that particular gas. He put 30 years of his time into it, and I would never have heard about this gas if it wasn't for him. And I wanted to research brown cat because it could do things that I needed to do in my lab. Now, I'm an alternative energy researcher. We're not getting into all the various things that you have to do my alternative my energy research, except to say that as the technology merges, for example, capacitive battery chargers work on the capacitive transformer thing, which then allows these sort of electrolyzers to become efficient, because the capacitive transformer considerably more efficient than a transformer or inductive transformer technology. It's used virtually everywhere, which comes back to those same engineers. If you want to take an AC source that's high voltage and transform it to a lower voltage AC, they virtually all use inductive or transformers. And they should have been using, back since Tesla, capacitive transformers for virtually at least 90% of what they've been doing. If they had, billions of watts would have been saved. It's an incredible technology. And here's a side effect of my research. Buell Brown wanted to use water as a fuel, and that's how he originally got into it and how he originally developed his water torch, which he called a welder. I call it a torch because you can't weld it, but it works as a torch. So in any case, Buell Brown wanted water and did that kind of research all of his life, never could get enough money together, and he built the water torches to help finance the research of water fuel. Daniel Dingell was and is still the old Filipino inventor, and he just is not giving up. I think he definitely has a water as fuel, a true water as fuel. In that he puts water into his battery-like device, and that's all he's putting in. Give a bunch. Send about 10 or 20 in that range. And they all run, and no one knows why. And he won't say. And I get a little frustrated about this sort of thing. Yes?
What would you guys do?
Okay. So again, Daniel Dingell, we can add to the list of press inventors because there's now a substantial rumor that he can both pay money and spend on his life. It's unfortunate. I wish someone could just develop these sort of things. They'll make a lot of money, whoever does that. I make enough money. I make enough money because I can pay my bills, I can finance my own research. I don't also, another policy I developed many years ago is not to take any government grants. If somebody's going to give me a grant, I want them to give me the money and go away. So the government won't do that. The government puts a huge amount of paperwork on a person, accountability, they eventually become your back pocket, and you start to feel like a puppet. I did a couple of little grant things when I was younger and decided it just wasn't worth it, and just because they made a policy, I won't do it. And I've got some words about that, which I won't get into now. Dan Meyer. Dan has something, I believe, and a relative of his got an equity. Will probably know about for Canada, but the again for various reasons, technology was suppressed, and the actual secret, if in my opinion, in terms of now. That we're all trying to think and trying to duplicate whatever it happened to be. It's not yet duplicated as far as I'm going successfully. The Joe Bell. I was actually in Australia last October. I didn't actually meet Joe, but I was in Brisbane, only about an hour's drive from where Joe lived. And I talked to quite a few people who have met him. And again, the technology seems to make completely sense. And the twist that makes it work, which I am quite convinced is working quite well, is just not something that is common knowledge. People are not being, well, it's a spotty success. Some people have been successful for at least periods of time with the technology, and some people have. So it hasn't been consistent duplicated. That's one of the things we're always looking for, is consistent duplication. So when you turn the key on your vehicle, it's going to start every single time for the different one. You have that sort of direction. People need to be able to have a different capability for the technology to actually be able to run. Paul Zagora, he had it. He really had it. He had an electrolyzer relatively recently, only a couple of years ago, you would expect. He had an electrolyzer that would take salt water, and that being the only fuel for the engine, be able to power racing. He had it. He just did. And one of his earlier experiments, circuit board he had, was Columbia Bay. And when the government suppressed him, they actually went to people who bought that circuit board and bought back to them. Again, the technology. It's relatively well documented on the internet. And just based off the board, he's still out there participating in water and fuel forums, but he doesn't actually say what he did. But it seems like he wants that, he wants somebody to rediscover it. On the other hand, he has paid a lot of money and cannot say, probably then have a set on his life as well. And people like to live. I like to live. So what I do to protect myself So what I do is to protect myself is I write the book. I put it out there. I'm not the only one who knows. As soon as I can, after I make an innovation, I do the best I can to get it published on me. Now, if they were smart, they probably read it anyway, who comes up with more and better innovations. But since I don't have control over the innovation directly anymore because it's a public domain, stopping me is going to stop it. And because it's out there, stopping me won't stop it. Other people like yourself from continuing to build, which is what the whole thing I'm trying to do. Make sure that people continue to build. So it isn't just enough to be an innovator. You have to make sure that the stuff is out there or it's life for nothing. As water and fuel goes, I had an experience that absolutely convinced me that it's possible. I don't know why it works. I can't duplicate it. I call it hyperbole. Because they had to close the brown gas, because I had a brown gas to spare enough money. And luckily I had a witness when the experiment did what it did. And what happened was it was producing about a bubble a second. And we were just sitting there because we're trying to optimize electrolyzers. And suddenly this experiment started to produce like 1,000 times more than that. It's practically in a quart size mason jar. It practically blew the water out of the jar. Now I'm saying blew because it wasn't exploded. It just started making a lot of gas. And other experimenters in water fuel have been noticing the same thing. When the experiment hits a certain whatever it is, it just suddenly feels like it is all the doors actually said, it's all voice as well. It feels like you got hit in the back of your pants with acceleration, the engine. It was just suddenly, that's it, that's the spot. Whatever it is that everything came together, that's it. Now this experiment continues to started making a lot of gas. It wasn't exciting about it. It didn't heat up. It didn't go back or anything. It just started making a lot of gas. And then after a few seconds, there was a tick sound, and then it just went back to a bubble of heck. Just something in that narrow of the zone. And it's the bubble that like the zone. If I hadn't been standing there actually looking at it at the time, I would have. Now, I know that experiment was overdue because it was being said at the time as part of my capacitive power system. And capacitive power supplies absolutely lock the amperage, and amperage is what we get. If the voltage can't change, if the voltage going around in the whatever room it's in, and if the voltage has changed that much, obviously the light in the room is what happens. It's much brighter. And there was so much more gas, it was blowing every light in the room, and that high, it's like 1,000 volts. So if it's that much gas, you know, kind of electrolyte. So the voltage stays the same, the light is bright, and the amperage is absolutely hot. So I was putting about 30 watts to the electrolyte, and it started to make enough gas that it would have fused the power to the engine in the, say, 300 GPM. That's my primary opportunity to do. Now, we'll talk about several different ways that it's possible to help make hydrogen sonic. I'm personally solving the plan to build my own house, and I'm going to have an anaerobic septic, which means that I asked my wife, for example, how would you like to cook it? Now, I was, of course, over dioxide, but the general idea is that you can make methane from your feet, and anything else goes down to the biological, so the bacteria, and that thing, which then I can add to, say, natural gas or propane that I have in the house, and part of the gas of food, which in this are common most countries in the world. It's virtually is only North America, which is not invasive, kind of got tens of thousands hooked up on village size. So that they can use the methane necessary to power the entire village. And you can add additional compostable matter than just the seeds so that we can generate enough gas to eat. So natural gas is a good way to do it. The key here is it's anaerobic. You have to have an anaerobic system. Aerobic systems are really easy to do, and energy collective society like we have, we just make it simple. But they say that one of the key components of civilization is then how they handle their excrement. The civilizations that have lived the longest have had excellent septic systems where they can put the excrement back in as fertilizer into the land. The ones that have lasted are the ones that have waste precious resource. So algae, it turns out, any algae, but if they're working for a specific strain, can produce hydrogen. Now, normally, in a photosynthesis, any green chlorophyll plant like actually oxygen, takes carbon dioxide and makes oxygen. Well, if we go in an oxygen-free environment, it actually makes hydrogen. But as soon as the hydrogen is being produced, it creates oxygen in the water, and oxygen locks the enzymes to make the hydrogen. So they haven't yet figured out how to make the process continue, but it actually is relatively efficient. It's called biophotolysis. I may be mispronouncing it, but I'm putting it up there anyway so that people can see the kind of things they need to search for online in order to find it. Or photobiological hydrogen production. So anything along that line you'll be able to find quite a bit on the internet. Now, there's also a separate type of hydrogen production called fermented hydrogen production. And again, it's algae and bacteria in a fermentation type of process. So that's another way to look at it. it wouldn't be too hard to create, if a person had a couple of different properties, that you could take a certain portion of it, an algae pond, and continue in another fashion as well. Once you have the algae, you have biomass, which is used for fertilizer, okay, but also for making biofuels in various ways. You can either burn it or directly, or you can make biogas, which is mostly methane, or biodiesel.
Thermochemical cycles,
These are cycles that use in various ways. Generally speaking, they're using them for the reactors. And one of them is the sulfur ionizing cycle by Ken Cho. So you can check these out. There are various ways that people are having to make it work. Okay. There's another one out there. I'll just try. Now, catalytic decomposition. Again, we have, and this runs along the same sort of thing as thermal chemical splitting in the water. But these are the kind of catalysts we're talking about. Cobalt phosphorus seems to be a very efficient one. And here is the one that I think is being used as a catalyst in the thermal water splitting, titanium oxide. Now, titanium oxide has been having a lot of interest. Can be done. For example, if you take and rub it on your mirror, you won't ever get foggy on your mirror in your bathroom. You just put a thin layer of titanium oxide on, and it won't fog up. It'll always be clear no matter how clean your bathroom is. Put titanium oxide, which traditionally is very white, on sides of buildings, the pollution then to the building disappears. It becomes absolutely clear. And it's persistent. It'll last for years. It doesn't seem to get some on it and what have you, because the product is not doing whatever the reaction is. It causes the pollution to go away. So there's a basement in France putting a lot of buildings with titanium oxide. But an interesting thing about this is one of the key components in the red blood cell, the dye cell, which is titanium oxide. And it looks like it's also thermal water splitting. So the titanium oxide, does anyone here know the most common place the first you find titanium oxide? Pardon? White paint's a good one. But that's not the most common. There you go. Toothpaste. And if you're duplicating the Dressel cells, generally speaking, they'll tell you both the first floor and find toothpaste has the titanium oxide in it. And toothpaste. There's a polyzine supermolecular complexes. Now, this is incredible. I don't know how this Karen Brewer actually figured this out. It was an accidental side effect of what she was doing. She found that with these certain complexes, she was trying to destroy bad cells, like cancer in the body. And these are cold activated supermolecular-like complexes. So once they're in the body, they can be light activated. So they put them in the body and then put lights on wherever the cancer cell is. And activate these complexes at that point and destroy the bad cells. It's a very nice technology for this, and it gets away from a lot of this more harsh and intrusive destroying type of technology that they have for dealing with cancer. She found as a side effect, interestingly enough, it's with water. These complexes, when they're light activated, with water. So there's a huge another research going on for that. So you can look up Karen Brewer and find out what she's doing with that. Amyloid. I'm thinking a lot of people here know about amyloid. It's been around for a long time. There are some people who have been duplicating it, and if anything I'm seeing on YouTube is true, doing a very nice job. Amyloid is originally developed as an alloy solder, and it turned out when you put it in water, it just spontaneously started the water to split. The water has to be elevated in temperature, it's boiling better, the more it will activate. But the standard speaking starts to dissipate the water all by itself. I had a similar thing happen in my lab. I don't know the composition of this particular cereal, but I had a bucket of lye sitting there where I poured off some very selective experiments. And one day I came into the lab and there was a stream of bubbles at the bottom of my bucket. And I thought that'd be interesting. I thought that wasn't. I kept an eye on it for a couple of days. by the name of Guido Franch, who, interestingly enough, he also had a green powder that was exactly the same. He turned water into 105 octane fuel, so obviously they did a lot more research. He called it MOTA, which is Adam spelled backwards. He demonstrated the MOTA fuel hundreds of times, but never produced it commercially. He did sell, according to this article off the internet, 3,000% of his rights to disinterested investors, and in 1973, that was the Dutch green power happening in 1973, was brought to court to demonstrate the motor transmission in the presence of judges who believed what they saw, and he was pushed to charge the fraud. Now, that's pretty dramatic. Again, we still don't have that picture fluid. In 1996, there's the Indian Institute of Technology, 3 years old, Ramar Pai Lai, had a secret little formula which did exactly the same thing. He put it into water and it became, as it said here, more efficient than gasoline and keeps no sulfur exhaust. So here we have what I call catalytic enhancement. Demonstrated many times over 100 years that actually makes water, this is what I was telling about before, a primary fuel, okay? Not an energy carrier where the energy comes from somewhere else. Something that is activating the water itself. And every single one of these inventors, all four of them, say pennies per gallon. But it's common material to somehow were put together and put in water, made it a combustible. I've seen YouTube videos of dough cell, which were a similar thing, where the water actually burned. It burned almost like it was alcohol. The same sort of a pretty good thing. And now, if Joe didn't put a powder in it, as far as I know, he put in some sort of electrical or some sort of energy fashion. But that's the kind of thing that happening up there, where water can actually end up being a primary fuel. It can be done. I know it can be done. I've seen things myself. I've seen enough evidence out there. Water as fuel can be a reality. Again, there's enough evidence that all we have to do is visit. We have to somehow find it. If the government was interested enough in this sort of thing, which they have, I actually talked with people who know something that the government has. They already have free energy, alternative energy, all sorted in the background. It's absolute fact. The anti-gravity devices all exist already. They're just not bringing it out for whatever reason. We have to duplicate it ourselves on the grassroots level if we want. Brown gas. I define it as the entire mixture of combustible gas that is generated from a machine specifically designed to electrolyze and split the water and not to separate the resulting gas. We don't have hydrogen going up on those and oxygen out of touch. William Rose called this, when he made his first patent on the type of gas, single method gas. And everything that comes out of there is what we call the brown gas. Major brand names of brown gas also include hydroxy, spirit gas, green gas, HHO gas is in it. It contains six constituents in various combinations. Water vapor, diatomic hydrogen, diatomic oxygen, monatomic hydrogen, and monatomic oxygen, and magnesium. The magnesium are the most important part of brown gas. The rest of which would be in my literature before is I wrote down gas book one, which is still valid and all of the same. More recent research shows that it isn't the monatomic hydrogen and oxygen that makes the gas dependent in brown gas, which by the way is approximately double the energy that you would get if you had bonded hydrogen and oxygen. So if you're doing energy calculations like when you're running an engine on brown gas, which by the way, engine time is extremely well around. From the, and you can hear 140 cubic inch Vega engine running by ground gas cable six operator. But it unfortunately it takes a lot of energy to run that. To idle that engine, there's no load on it at 500 RPM. Took about 3 kilowatts, I'm sorry, 9 kilowatts of energy from the wall. So there's no way the well can either produce the gas on that engine, even though the engine runs on the gas itself. So if you already have 9 kilowatts, you might as well put it in the motor and go back further on that electricity with the gas carbon crazy internal by the engine. But in any case, the magnitudes which were identified by Dr. Fantilli in Florida were, he found the reason why, first of all, that monatomic hydrogen and oxygen can this basic interest stable in the first place. Monatomic hydrogen and oxygen are not supposed to exist. Look at on the internet, talk to any physicist or skeptic out there, they'll say ground gas, no mixture of hydrogen and oxygen can contain any significant amount of hydrogen and oxygen. Yet, the worst quality ground gas out there is an artificial monatomic hydrogen and oxygen. Now, that's 3% of the difference in energy production, but it is significant that it exists at all. And it is significant because of magnitudes. Magnitudes are structures of molecules. You have atoms, which make molecules, and the molecules and atoms, which have monatomic hydrogen and oxygen, make another structure called an aggregate. Real ground calls it a fluid crystal. I call it electrically expanded water because I didn't know any of it was a threat. Because of different kinds of test techniques that were available to Professor Fantilli, he was able to actually see the structure of this bank, which then produced a lot larger atomic weight than just molecules of hydrogen oxygen or water molecules. So the magnitudes are where the extra energy of ground gas is stored, and it's stored essentially as an electrical energy. So the water absorbs electrical energy and turns it into a basic form of water, which is not steam. And it's stable. It will be like that for years. Until something ignites it, it releases that energy. And that's why the ground gas flame is more an electrical plane than steam. Now, the internal combustion, using ground gas in internal combustion, has been commercially available since the 1970s. As I was saying, I already had been doing experiments, but I was duplicating people who were already out there in the marketplace doing steam stove, this hydrogen generation system, the green first guy. Seriously, put on more electrolyzers on a vehicle. I've got thick documentation, testimonials, and stuff on all the kind of things that he had. And essentially, you could replace between 5% and 50% of the fuel with the water. Water being the ground generated from the onboard electrolyzer. And the reason you could do that had to do with how ground gas affects carbon fuel. And that's going to be a relatively large part of what I'm going to be talking about next. What happens is a carbon fuel has bonds, atomic bonds, between the carbons and hydrogen. It takes energy to break those bonds. When that's called endothermic, that's the energy put into the combustion process, self-propagating energy, the energy that the combustion needs to self-propagate. So, to self-propagate. So, you put this energy in. Then they split apart into their atomic constituents, and they reform into gaseous combustion, carbon dioxide and water. And this is all carbon-based fuel burning, degrading with carbon dioxide and water. And as they recombine, they give off energy, because the energy it takes to recombine is less than the energy that was available. So the excess energy comes out of heat. So the main thing the ground gas does is reduce the amount of energy necessary to break apart the atomic bond. So the endothermic energy is dramatically reduced. Ground gas acts like a catalyst to decrease the amount of energy necessary for self-propagation, and it's really dramatic. And because it can get really dramatic, that's why onboard electrolyzers work. Because it takes about 7 watts of fuel to make 1 watt of brown gas. So you can't take the brown gas and put it back into the engine and have a self-propelling machine, because you just lost 7 times of the energy just in the process of burning and making the gas, because of the efficiency of the internal combustion engine, on and on like that. So that's what we call a negative price. If it wasn't for the brown gas's ability to dramatically lower the amount of energy that it takes to break the fuel apart, you would just lose mileage whenever you put this on, because it takes more energy than it's getting back. But because you get back more energy from the fuel than it took to make the brown gas in the beginning, you actually have a gain in mileage. So you end up maintaining power and performance, and we are going to be making large engines, making the sale for large engines soon. At the moment, we are selling the electrolyzers for small vehicles, hand-wheel vehicle or drive, so someone can have this particular one that's sitting up here. Now, this is my little famous endorsement, where I have my brother holding one of our high orders. This happens to be one he put on his own vehicle. He's got a 30% increase in Dodge. Perhaps he had a handy limit, a large one with 6 jets. And it's doing really well. It's been almost a year since he installed it. It has been absolutely trouble-free, all that kind of stuff. That's my brother. There's thousands of people out there doing exactly the same sort of thing. Now, that's not to say that it'll work on every vehicle, because there are various things necessary, mostly in the computer, that need to be addressed. Now, Buffalo just put it on and it works. Then one of those there are vehicles that require a modification to the oxygen sensor, for example, because when you increase the efficiency of combustion, you end up burning less, you end up with less carbon monoxide, which goes to CO2. You end up with less oxides of nitrogen. That almost goes to CO2. So the oxygens that were tied up in those two constituents of the exhaust, that oxygen is free. And because you use less fuel with the same power, you end up putting less fuel into the engine. So the air that's going in, you burn your less oxygen. When we were burning carbureted vehicles, when we started burning carbureted vehicles, we noticed they consistently got a 2% rise in exhaust oxygen whenever production enhancement technology is applied. So, and 2% is the difference between life and death. When you've got about 14% oxygen output, you really, it's a little bit too little for most people to survive. But 16%, you can survive. Most people can. So that was the difference. I actually had hamsters living in the exhaust of vehicles that I had these things on. Yeah. Just put a big bag around the cage and put the exhaust in there. And they did. Okay.
So what happens if they didn't make it?
If they didn't make it?
Yeah. I'll be still
around. Okay, well, I'm not going to go over into that side because I want, but the point of the matter is the hamsters could survive in the exhaust of vehicles until we insist, again, our exhaust would be taken out of the vehicle if you have proper combustion in your engine. So, that being internal combustion, exactly the same thing works with external combustion. We're coming on to winter, we're going to have a lot of people burning fuel in their furnaces, except those people that are anarchists and here in the province of British Columbia with less and abundant hydro. But a lot of people in the world are using various kinds of carbon fuel to burn. And I, to my own shop, are using natural gas out of the pipeline. I have replaced 50% of my natural gas with brown gas. And in this particular case, all carbon waste fuel from methane, propane, if you were using any of the butane, gasoline, diesel, even coal, any carbon-based fuel In fact, as I say, we're testing it now in both our homes, but here we have South Korea claiming 90% water to 10% oil. This is a very heavy oil that they're using, crude oil, like the burning ship engine, and they're able to actually replace, by using the brown gas as a catalyst and adding water injection, they're able to replace 90% of the fuel with water. So they're only burning 10% of what they did before, and achieving the same power and heat output that they did before. Like I said, it's incredibly dramatic. The flame changes. In our lab, we had a university student come up from New York State, and this is a hole to a tiger torch. And as you can see, it's a relatively yellow flickering flame turned into a long blue type flame when we added the brown cap. Now, this is without additional water injection. My experience with adding a mixture of gasoline, water, diesel, and heating the entire mixture in a special heat exchanger and putting it out is a flame turned entirely transparent. So you could light things on fire several inches away from the burner, but you could not see a flame at all. Now, the practical mixing of brown gas and natural gas using our particular technology, here we took a regular water cooler, turned it into, with a pump, a small pump, just an aquarium pump that would be for bouncing. So relatively low pressure system. All this is low pressure system. Natural gas, after the regulator, only operates up to about half an inch of pressure. So the brown gas machine, it's been modified so it has an automatic water feed, so you don't have to worry about going in and telling you about it. Just automatically does it itself. And this, the actual one is in my shop working right now, and it uses about 5 gallons a liter and cuts my gas consumption by 50%. The other interesting thing is that the electricity necessary for all my costs to make the brown gas is only 10% of the cost of the natural gas. So my net result is that I'm using, I'm getting a 40% net savings in my cost. Now, because I'm not in my lab all the time and what have you, it meant my 1,300 square foot laboratory with ceiling as high as this cost me only $20 to heat and gas utilities. Again, here what we have to use the plumbing to put the right here. All I did was just the sediment tube. I just simply took off that, put in a valve, and this is the hose coming from my test plug. So this is the hose going up. I can turn on the gas, and as soon as the pressure comes in from here, it overrides the pressure coming in from the regulator, the gas line regulator. And the brown gas starts coming here. Now, all mixes right in here, and then it comes out into the burn to the valve there. Now, an advantage of my particular style of electrolyzer is that since I'm using a capacitor limited to the power supply, depending on the capacitor that you have, it absolutely locks the amount of gas you're producing. And of course, you go off and just. So, generally speaking, most of the time, what's happening is produce at 400 liters an hour, and the gas pressure automatically equalizes to that. So since the furnace produces about 800 liters an hour, that means that the pressure here will rise enough to overcome the pressure coming in from here, sort of putting out the 400 liters an hour, and then the excess 400 liters an hour comes in from the other side. So here we have the two gases merging and mixing, and it automatically adjusts the pressure to the gas. It's beautiful and simple. And here, I just simply have the electricity. I monitor the electricity. This wire here goes over to the electricity. And as soon as the valve turns on to turn on gas, going through the furnace, the brown gas machine, the electricity, the water torch turns on and starts feeding gas from the cell. The water torch is not filling gas all the time. It only produces the gas when the furnace is actually turned on and running. Very simple, easy to do, and I get a 40% net dollar return. And this works any of the people who are out there. Now, if you've got diesel, for example, from the current level, you can't look at previous issues, all those things, research going on with that as well. So you just put it in with the intake air, and the same thing. It just depends on the plane when it's actually returned. So, another way of using water fuel is as an actual force fuel, which is the ground gas electrolyzers that we're working with. And it replaces the acetylene directly and any other force fuel. People tend to be using that propane, acetylene, any of those, natural gas. And if it's superior in cutting, brazing, soldering, preheating, it cuts faster, it preheats less expensively, it's more precise to flame, it's very laser-like. If I had samples here, you'll be able to see the absolute precision. When it makes the cut, you have to have a micrometer to tell the difference between the top and the bottom of the cut. There's no tapering, there's no cupping, there's no golden edge, anything. It just slices the metal like a nice piece of butter. Very accurate. It makes semi-precious material. I personally made rubies, emeralds, sapphire, and moonstone in my with my torch to see the various types of raw rock necessary to do that. And it's in jewelry work, it's absolutely fabulous. You can have micro torches. You can actually do precision work on any little piece. And because it has extremely low radiant heat, it doesn't heat up anything that's right next to it. You can do your work exactly where you need to. Very laser-like. It's working with glass, quartz. There was a quartz artist in Ground Gas Studio 1. You'll see the quartz. You'll see a quartz artist, a Russian quartz artist, who makes fabulous work. He can make quartz flowers and birds and all kinds of things. It's amazing the work that he does. And I have him on tape saying that Ground Gas is perfect quartz working gas. It's absolutely stoichiometric mixture, and it has a higher energy content than the bottled hydrogen or oxygen that he was using before. And always before, he would have issues trying to get the exact flame, the exact stoichiometric 2-part hydrogen, 1-part oxygen flame for the bottle. So with the Ground Gas machine, you never have to worry about that. It's exactly stoichiometric all the time, no matter what. Solar cells, rubies, all these things are normally using hydrogen and oxygen gas now, but they, again, it comes from liquefied hydrogen and oxygen bottles and tanks. And they lose about, well, a huge amount of their gas just keeping the containers full without the temperature. We store the hydrogen and oxygen in a liquid form as well, but it's still liquid with the temperature. So, as a torch gas, it's the safest known gas because it's only torch gas that is lighter than air. So then if it's escaping but not burning, the hydrogen just rises and dissipates into the atmosphere, and it's virtually impossible for them to have to use a steel-type room to build a combustible mixture of the gas in that room. Totally environmentally compatible, there's nothing in the gas that will hurt anything. Hydrogen and oxygen are benign in the environment and to our biological cells. As I was pointing out before, this is an electrical energy, not a thermal energy. So you have a very low temperature flame with a very high energy content. So even though the temperature of the flame is low, when you direct it at something, it'll turn a stone, for example, incandescent, bright white hot in just an instant. And you can keep that stone red hot almost a foot away. It's one of our torches. There's no other torch in the world. It's an imploding flame because it actually is turning back into water. And when it turns into water, it's trapped 1,800 metric tons. So when it's in a machine and you turn the water into the gas, it's bam, 1,800 metric tons. When you turn it back into the water, it's trapped. So it actually makes a tunnel in the air, which is one of the reasons it maintains the laser-like function. The air pressure itself is holding it, and it has an infrared vacuum tunnel. Holding it and training it to a very good point. So the ER-1200 water torch, here I have some samples of the ones that were built and just on very simple assembly lines and going out the door. They're actually selling faster than you can build. And again, another one of my shameless endorsements. That's the water pressure of the project. That would be about 3 years. There's been significant increases in design, surface level and quantity of gas and quality of gas. But the as it's gone out there, they say if you make something better, you'll find a better idiot. I excuse my best for my customers. When I they make mistakes I wouldn't make. Because I know the gas, I know what I'm doing. When I send the machines out there, they're being handled by people who don't know what they're doing. So I have to design the machines in such a way that people who don't know what they're doing don't hurt themselves or anything. Well, I had don't hurt themselves down through PAC, but I was getting broken machines because people were doing very things that I had no idea what people were doing. So I designed the machines where those sort of things are cured, and then I continue to use the experience of my customers to design machines that we've all had over the years. So again, what is brown gas? Well, that brown gas actually is an example of how current ways of thinking are failing us. This room is being one of the exceptions. There are common things out there. People don't understand what brown gas is, what it does, what the advantages of alternative energy technologies are, how many different ways we can improve our quality of life or maintain our quality of life with considerably smaller energy footprint. In North America, we use twice as much energy for the same standard of living as we do in the world. It's ridiculous, I'm sorry to say. And because of the way it is, longer distances and colder temperatures and whatever, Canadians are worse than Americans. And so we really need to pick up our costs. And I'm glad to see our government doing a lot of good work. Brown gas is one of the answers we need. It has a huge number of potential. Some of the people are understanding those. We can get into that a little bit more later. Interestingly enough, as I was pointing out before, water fuel and brown gas are actually a side effect. I wasn't actually intending to be in this. So I'm an alternative energy researcher. I look at the kinds of energy that, like gravity and heat, ambient heat, that you can't, that aren't on the shelf yet. If you have hydro or wind or solar, photovoltaic, I don't bother experimenting with those fields, except in the point where technologies like this can make it more efficient. So brown gas is a brown coal opportunity with already developed potential, meaning that the machines already exist, and we're looking at making better and better applications over time. You're going to see a lot more about brown gas and heat power too. At this point, we'll take some questions.
With water being greater than
the lady here is saying, "When what do we do if we start using water as a fuel? Won't we start running out of fresh water or water because water is already short demand in a lot of places in the world? In fact, I'm very concerned because Canada has the largest by a significant percentage of the freshwater world, and our neighbors in the south is running out of water all over the place. Not enough of our water, as well as other unnatural resources. But getting back to the actual point, there's a lot of places in the world where people actually carry water for miles or for half a day, just getting enough water that they need to survive. If we start using water as a fuel, are we going to run out of it like we would supposedly running out of oil? It's a legitimate concern. I can definitely say that. However, there are lots of ways of taking fresh water. There are a really amount of technology
take water from the air. Clearly, if you get in high humidity situations right down this and you can actually place these various devices that have been for a long time in the ocean, and they can simply collect the humidity in the air, this up above, then up below the tube, and it just generates fresh water just from the ambient energy around. So even though you may be in the desert where you don't have the water, again, water is relatively rough, like they would have bringing oil to the place, and obviously not more environmentally compatible and more difficult with the fact that you strength as well as use power. I think that sort of infrastructure, if we enlighten yourself enough to be able to help decide where to use, wouldn't be power. There's enough water on the planet. The surface of the planet is most covered. I don't think it's going to be a problem finding enough fresh water to do what I want. So the question is, will interrupting the natural cycle of water that goes from the oceans and then from the land that goes down, are we going to interrupt that cycle enough that it could affect our environment? And my personal opinion is that the amount of water that we would need permanently is significant compared to the amount of water that is naturally going to the environmental cycle. And if we started using enough water that it could be, it would start to be significant, it would be as a whole. And it would compensate for that. The second part of the question has to do with what happens to the water. And this is another reason why I think it's not an issue, because the water, most of the technologies that you're talking about, is either recycled immediately before local environment, or it just goes into the atmosphere. The water is not destroyed. In fact, in a lot of the cases, we end up with more water than we have to sink. Like if we went to a sustainable hydrogen society that at first was using the methyl hydrate, the water that we've achieved from that is huge compared to the, we end up with excess water because we're burning fossil fuels, which is net result of water and carbon dioxide. So, in the process of this, first of all, if that's great water, you're not losing the water from the environment. It's not going anywhere, it's not being destroyed, it's not being hurt. And that is an important thing. The water, as people here probably know, the photos here, water is more than the life of the element on the planet that we know it. It actually to have an immense reservoir of information that we have to take care of stuff. So the water is important to curious things.
The fact that you're sharing your technology, you are something like Bill Garvin and Bob next year. If I'm going back to the studies, bring it so far forward. But even in your process,
the comment was that graduate being
home, I was, when I was in Australia, I was talking to my wife, did a computer, video phone, so I picked up the camera and showed her out what Australia looked like. So a person could actually video whatever's going on in various ways. Other people could access whatever the information is, put their thoughts in, and the synergy of lots of minds takes on everything. There's no one mind to take very much. If we could multiple minds put on something, we usually end up with something better than any of those minds to think of on their own. Was whether a leasing option would work with the water course so that it's more expensive equipment. But most people, if they buy one of our water courses, it's putting up something on the order of $6,000 to $6,500 water course. So they even though we're selling the same as it's used, unfortunately, it kind of says, I don't see the reason at this time. But it's also taking up a lot of my time. So what I'm looking to do is outsource, find other manufacturers to start making equipment. But quite frankly, I need to get back into my lab. I need to get back into my lab. This manufacturing of all the various products that we have doesn't bring money into my pocket. Quite frankly, I'm bored. I need to get back into my lab and develop the next stage of whatever is going on. So what I need first is to find manufacturers that are willing to take on manufacturing of traded products and take them out into the marketplace. Because quite frankly, I don't want to do the manufacturing or the marketing. The main reason I do it is because I think the best there is. If there's somebody else out there doing a better job, I would just prefer to do that. I don't have time doing the best of that.
How many units a month?
How many am I making or how many
can
you sell?
How many units are you selling?
Except that I don't want to go there.
So in a lot of words anyway.
Leasing is an excellent way of leveraging whoever takes over.
Right.
Absolutely. And already there are plenty of
what's important now,
when I advertised, I was selling for a few months. I was talking minimal advertising in the range of a couple $1,000. I haven't advertised for several years because I'm only selling water courses to the side effect.
You could probably get 300 a month. For about 2/3 cost.
And that's exactly right. Yes, copy before Relic. What it does is it does it all with torch surface better than any other tool. And that includes the cutting of the steel. It cuts 25% faster than any other torch tool. Because it all depends on the oxidation process of that iron. And Rouse gas oxidizes iron 25% faster than any other tool on Earth. So the cutting of steel is where torch is used a lot. So that's why the Rouse gas is so much better in that application. There's also the welding of aluminum, the pre-heating of metal, the brazing and soldering. When we buy our machine, all the silver soldering is done to connect the metal inside was done with Rouse gas. Because there just isn't a better way of silver soldering than this concrete. Unfortunately, as far as I can find so far, there isn't an over unit of heating available for ground gas. I'm saying so far. There's some research I'd like to do, but heat of stone, for example, a tungsten or anything else that goes like magnesium oxide that goes white hot as soon as the flame is put in. It does go white hot, but it doesn't actually put out any more heat than you would have had if you had taken electricity to make a grouse gas and put it into an electric heating element. Now it goes to higher temperatures, but if you go BTU to BTU, it's the same. So the grouse gas itself doesn't radiate any heat, and in fact, if you're using it pure, if you use it as a mixture, you've got a good thing going on. But if you use it pure, for example, out of the burner for an outside stove, put a pot on it, the flame will just punch right through the pot. Because the more resistant to heat the material is, the faster this flame will punch through it. Okay? You have, when you have a kiln, for example, you have the little pieces inside that are supposed to withstand like 5,000 degrees heat in order to put your materials on and what have you. The ceramic kiln material, the ground gas flame punches right through it just about as fast as so what happens is you're putting an electrical energy directly into the material. And those molecules have to react to that electrical energy. That electrical energy is in there, it will melt, do whatever is necessary to stabilize itself, get rid of the excess energy. And since it's very laser-like, it happens right at that point. And if material, like aluminum, for example, if you directly blend against aluminum, it generally won't punch through it unless it's really thin, relative thin aluminum. Because aluminum can radiate away the heat fast enough once you get, like, the information. So you generally won't punch through it with the ground-based flame, or it takes a lot longer. Whereas you go with the ceramic, it punches right through. Because it localizes the heat, and it builds right through. Also, it doesn't take any oxygen from the environment, like a settling flame does. So once the flame goes in, it just keeps going. As long as you've got your flame, you can keep right through. The advantage of that had to do with flame drilling, for example, and Transylvania bought a water torch for that specific purpose. They're putting fiber optic cable in here, and the building will still hold the stone to crumble if they use the drill to drill some rock. So they use the ground gas to flame drill through the rock, which not only interrupts the stone, but also it has glass encapsulated tunnel to the stone to fiber optic to drill through.
Interesting about the makeup of the
There is definitely a commercial value. Some in small cases, of course, but also in relatively large ones. Feldspar, for example, takes up about a third of your truck. And feldspar turns into coatings, stronger than steel, and pure sulfur transparent. It has a little iron in it, black. But
Popular Mechanics a little while ago did it about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago now. Did an article on just what they call glass bridges. And that's exactly the kind of thing grouse cats can do, and no other cats on earth, but economically, can actually turn the box into bridges made out of semi-precious material or buildings or anything. They can never go
if I put one of these units in my car, and I was achieving 20% increase in fuel economy, and I ran on a trip where I used up 10 gallons of gasoline, how many gallons of water do I use up?
If you put one of these in your vehicle, you will use approximately 10 to 20 milliliters of water per tank of gas.
Okay.
More of your gas into that water injection and actually replace the water. As they were doing with Korea, they were actually replacing fuel with water, but only if you had the brown gas and the catalyst. So there's two different technologies we're talking about.
How many watts would I be using up on my trip?
This
continually.
This would be somewhere in the about 14 volts and a couple of amps.
So 30 watts?
28 watts.
Okay. Would I be wearing out the electrodes in the...
No, not be wearing out the electrodes. They last the life of the vehicle. Power electrolyte design, we figured out how to keep the voltage below the electrode deposition of the metal. The metal doesn't migrate from one place to another.
Thank you.
How do we keep the water from freezing in the winter? It's the catalyst inside, the lye. It acts just like the acid in the battery. It prevents the water from freezing. Now, if it's really cold, it can turn into a slush. But as soon as the electricity starts to run through the machine, the slush turns back to liquid and the machine works. I've been operating this machine in the winter for over a decade.
Given the
people
you
could
tell
me,
do you have any for
cars? No, not at this time. We're working to get something like that happening. You should understand that my company is standing in front of me. And I'm incorporated simply because it makes it easy for me to my taxes right off and all that kind of thing. But I'm really a one-man vendor operation. And between myself and some practically volunteer labor, we've been able to service hundreds of thousands, produce amazing amounts of product, and get it out there. At the same time, I've been able to write all these books. I do. But when it comes down to it, there's a very small team involved in a long time, so there's a few things I'd like to do but aren't able to. Now, we are going to restart the system to do that platform. What we're going to do is outsourcing our product. We're also going to outsource most of the marketing, whereby then our website will act as a clearinghouse where people can, once they understand how to build and install register, and then anyone anywhere can go to the website and see installer system. And I just take myself out of the bottleneck and allow people to build their own network of themselves.
Ben Thomas, I just did my first contact with the
age to be able to move. The question had to do with hydrogen embrittlement, and that's an urban myth. It's practically impossible to have the hydrogen in a given situation to brittle any of the metal having external combustion or locate the external combustion. Roy McAllister, for example, has hydrogen cylinders, which have been holding high pressure hydrogen since the Zeppelin days. Okay? And they still pass the pressure test and safety. One of the things that he does is test the sort of bottle. And they keep in the high pressure bottles, which take high pressure and high heat to get enough hydrogen into this iron to cause it to boom. So, again, hydrogen pipeline, with syrup, for example, with that hydrogen pipeline, like the potassium on a consistent basis, keep the pressure on the back, not embrittling hydrogen. So, like adding water to the fuel, this is another one that you're gonna miss. They say if you put water, if you put 50% of your fuel with water, you're going to have to put in famous for the dust valve to change the fuel. And the answer is, the engine is already rusted from all the water that's burning a bottle. When you burn a gallon of gasoline, you make like 9 gallons of water. So that water rusts your exhaust system up inside. Anybody that puts the exhaust system, no, not burning exhaust system, rusts out inside. So, interestingly enough, when you replace half of your fuel with water, you actually burn, you actually take only 4.5 gallons of water, plus that half a gallon, that 5 gallons of water going out to the process. So, add water, so it's similar to what we talked about. Okay, there was a question up there. Yeah, anytime you're burning, and there's a lot of burning going on in these sort of things, you could end up with more efficiency. Okay, you should have, as you came in, the beef brochure, and this is part of the usually for distributors that aren't in place at the moment. If you could somehow make note of this particular code that I'm showing you here, H5D or Z, 1-207. That code is good for 3 months in our feed store for a 20% discount on anything that's there. And the store is Google-Research. Don't forget the hyphen. Go off the insurance site, but don't put it in there. .com/store.
Okay, just for the listeners, the discount code is capital HYZ1-207. That is Hotel Yankee Zebra 1-207. The website is www.eagle-research.com/store. Again, that's www.eagle-research.com/store.
So, I say it's time to railroad. What that means is all the technologies are in place. We need to put them together. The railroads as we know them today didn't exist until there was rail, which they invented to put down in the mines so they could move the cart, and steam engines, which then could eventually be put on a locomotive to pull the cart. So you have rails, carts, and engines. All those things have to exist when you have a railroad. Everything necessary to sustainable hydrogen economy exists today. All we need is the will, political will, the grassroots will to make it happen. There's lots of different ways to happen. I want to thank the
first one to do it first. What would it cost to buy those?
The conversion on the car, generally speaking, $388 US. We sell everything in US dollars. I'm sorry to say that US dollars is about 10. Actually, down from 1.3. But it went back to the Canadian winter outstream. But we do business around the world through the investment of all of our products and services. The $388 for this probably needs one or more of the E5 devices. So, and there's about $20 to $30 required. You're looking in the $500 range. It's 25% or better what it takes. Most people get that.
How many hours?
It'll take about 4 to 8 hours to assemble it, depending on your skills. And again, another about 4 to 8 hours to put it on the machine. Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons this technology over my previous gas transportation technology called HICO today. Now, it turns out I'm going to reintroduce the HICO today without working. But again, I have several technologies on the shelf that I'm not even got in the market yet. Perfectly viable, that I just can't individually support the product.
My friend Al just mentioned that the flow rate you have out of this unit is extremely small relative to the gas consumption of a car engine. So the reason why it produces a 20% increase in efficiency is because of this catalytic action with the hydrocarbon fuel. Is that it? That's where you get all the advantage?
That's correct.
Because the fuel, I mean, you burn that, there's like nothing there, right?
Yeah. If you burn this gas directly, it would operate a microcircuit.
Exactly. There's nothing.
Very small thing to set itself. The question was, this tiny amount of gas, how can it get, what's the reason why it's a 25% increase in mileage? You're not actually running the engine on this gas. That's a very important point to keep in mind, because, and this was the last question, and then go on to draw things. It's a very important point to keep in mind because we actually use this gas as a catalyst, and it doesn't take much. A lot of the water fuel technologies or water for fuel technologies that are out there are using too much. The Heiser technology, both of them, you'll see in there what we're talking about. Generally speaking, there's a certain amount of this gas that optimizes. A very small amount is the biggest gain. A tiny amount more is less of a gain. Again, the same amount more, it's an amp. Every time you add an amp, you get less of a gain because it starts to approach the optimum amount of catalyst. Once you go past the optimum amount, you actually start losing mileage. So there's a lot of people out there making much gas. So again, it comes back again to efficiency. With our technology, the latest design of Hydro, we've lowered the amount of watts, to produce a lot of ground gas from 7 to 5. So that's a significant change in the efficiency that you end up with by moving this curve over. You can make more gas with less electricity, reach that optimum point quicker. So this amount that's coming out of here will do a 5-liter engine with it and hit that 25% efficiency. You don't need much. It's very important that the quality of the gas is much more important than the quantity of gas. You want to maximize the magnitude. And this design that we've got in here is designed to maximize the magnitude. So they say, okay, the plate spacing is almost a great thing. In the more efficient gas production, there are plant cyclizers that produce a slightly higher volume of gas for the amount of amperage going through. The quality of gas, you have less magnitude of gas. So it's important to increase the amount of the gas, the percentage of gas actually does affect. Thank you very much. We'll go on to the...
I was just going to have a draw on some prices. And James, are you listening in? Hello? Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Hello?
Hello, George?
Yes.
James?
Yes, still here.
Okay, we're done, and they just are having a draw for some prizes.
Oh, very good. So we can conclude
and
the program then?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, well,
thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you for including us in your meeting. I'm sure that's proved to be beneficial to those who have been willing to put up with the less-than-perfect engineering, but it was a great effort on your part to hold that phone for us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You know, anything for the cause.
Well,
and
maybe next time we can have a little better sound hookup so that it'll come through a little better.
Okay. Well, did you get anything? Did you hear some of the things?
Yeah. For those who are willing to put their ear to the speaker of their computer, the information is there, and I really appreciate it.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, happy to be of help, and
okay,
let's
so
keep
much.
In touch.
Appreciate
okay,
it.
James. Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.